Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
At this moment, light is reaching me from not long after the birth of the universe. If I look far enough into the past, I can see that this moment, this self, is the culmination of a 13.7 billion year gestation process. And in the time it took me to write this, something new has already been born. The first intellectual interest of my life was space. Even before I entered school, I begged my parents for a telescope, took classes at the planetarium. I dreamt of the stars. In this way, I cultivated awe as only a child can, as only an encounter with such immensity can. And at the same time, my most terrifying nightmares came not in the form of bogeymen waiting in my closet, but from the encounter with the immensity of the cosmos. Without any spiritual, cosmological framework in which to place my study of the universe, I was terrified of the vastness of space. Like Blaise Pascal, who once wrote of this seemingly meaningless void, I feel engulfed in the infinite immensity of space whereof I know nothing, in which nothing know of me. I'm terrified. The science I learned in school was equally bereft of meaning, and it lacked even the awe-inspiring quality of my early childhood. I turned away from science, from the cosmos, to find more meaningful fields of study, such as religion and literature. My journey, however, was not so simple. While the notion that meaning was found in the humanities, the exclusive realm of the human mind, can be occupied, I never quite let go of the stars. There was always somewhere an intuition that meaning could not merely be found in the human mind, but there was something not quite right about the idea of the human world. Meaning and cosmos were entirely separate realms. The idea that the human created wisdom separately from the cosmos seems suspiciously hierarchical, dualistic. If we, like the dolphin and the mountain and the insect and the stars, emerged from the same process, did our wisdom not come from the same source? Our ancestors sat by the fire under the stars and told stories. Stories that connected us to the world in which we live and enabled us to be compassionate to one another. The earliest humans had few defenses against the harsh world in which they found themselves. As they wandered out into the dry plains of Africa, there would have been less plentiful food than in the less lush jungle. The prey they encountered would have been bigger, faster, and stronger. Many predators would have found the human an easy target. While it is undoubtedly true that humanity's greatest tool for survival was our intelligence, intelligence alone would not have sufficed. Humans required cooperation and compassion for survival. They connected to one another in loving relationship and worked together to ensure survival of the group. They sang songs and performed rituals to give creative expression to these relationships. The clan and the ecosystem was the womb in which the first humans lived. This is wisdom. This is how we learn to be human. At each moment in human history, we have had to ask ourselves how we can be fully human in our current situation. At each moment, we have had to figure out how to connect to our world. Today is no different. But for the first time, humans have failed to come up with meaningful new stories to replace those that no longer give us meaning. The great emptiness of the cosmos is not because the world is meaningless, it's because we are failing to fulfill the central role of the human being in the world, to find meaning in human terms. Like the earliest people, we are at the edge of our world, bringing forth the connections of the past and called upon to create a meaningful future. We are poised between these depths, at the chaotic matrix of the birth canal of the cosmos. Perhaps they saw this when they painted their handprints on the caves, one of the earliest great works of art. Surely they had seen their children's handprints on the womb and recognized that they too were in a womb, the womb of the cosmos. The story of the universe is the story that ends as it began. The spark of the Big Bang is in each of us. We have, at this moment, through our creativity, the capacity to create anew the universe, to become compassionate to the whole of creation. Chaos, and surely we live in chaotic times, is the mother of creative transformation. Even as our individual interiority emerges, our creative, imaginative capacities allow us to return to embeddedness in the cosmic womb. This return requires more than new knowledge, but a new myth, a way of connecting us to one another, to the rest of the earth, and to the cosmos. The new myth will not be created by science or philosophy, but by the collective creativity of humanity. We'll need more than mere ideas. To be remade and renewed from our very roots, to become pure and ready to climb the stars, we need new poets, like Dante. We are at this moment, like my unborn daughter, putting handprints on the edge of our world, our womb, not unlike the earliest humans did in the interior of the cave, unsure what lies beyond. Brian Thomas Swim is the director of the Third Story of the Universe, the Human Energy Project, and professor of cosmology at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He received his PhD from the Department of Mathematics at the University of Oregon in 1978 for work in gravitational dynamics. He brings the context of story to our understanding of the 13.8 billion year trajectory of the universe. Such a story, he feels, will assist in the emergence of a flourishing Earth community. Swim is the author of The Hidden Heart of the Cosmos and The Universe is a Green Dragon. He is co-author of The Universe Story, which is the result of a 10-year collaboration with cultural historian Thomas Berry. His most recent book is Cosmogenesis. Swim is also the creator of three educational video series, Canticle to the Cosmos, The Earth's Imagination, and The Powers of the Universe. With Mary Evelyn Tucker, he co-wrote and hosted the 60-minute film Journey of the Universe, broadcast on PBS television stations nationwide. His most recent media work, written with Monica Duras Bowles, is the popular 34-part Story of the Noosphere series, available on YouTube. He lectures widely and has presented at conferences sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the World Bank, UNESCO, the United Nations Millennium Peace Summit, and the American Museum of Natural History. Brian Swim, welcome to Reimagining.
Great to be here, Theodore. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to open by talking about your most recent book, Cosmogenesis, which I recently read and really enjoyed. And I think I've said that it's very different from your other work in that it's a memoir. Yeah. It's a story about your life, but also a story about the cosmos, as all your work is. I guess I'd like you to talk about why you decided at this stage to write a memoir and how that became a vehicle for you for teaching about the cosmos and about the universe story.
I really wanted to give expression to the way in which this gigantic cosmos surfaces in our daily life. Like everybody else, when I think about the cosmos or the universe, I think about stuff, you know, way out there, like galaxies and stars and way out. But the truth is, the whole universe is suffused with creative energy. And so it shows up in our ordinary life. We go through the day and we may not be aware of it, but the universe as a whole is involved. And so I wanted to write something that would help people see the universe present in their lives. Exploding stars are present in our daily lives if we know how to think about our existence. That was the main idea, to bring it home, write something that was personal and people could relate to, as opposed to a standard science book. It's cold and neutral. It's about stuff out there. That was the main idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. It must be, as a scientist or with someone whose background is in science, that we have this amazing history, this kind of Western science that has revealed so many wonderful and amazing things, in some ways rests on this premise of this separation of the subject and object, of the scientist or the human and nature and the world and the observed, right? And it rests on this notion. That's how we've learned so many amazing things through that process of this sort of detached observation. And in the end, turns back on itself. And we realize that very premise is somehow not real in a way. Does that make sense?
Completely. No, that's the shock, is that we, to go at the what you just said from another angle, like Albert Einstein, Isaac Newton, all of the major scientists just regarded the universe as this huge, huge event. And then as something separate from us, we humans had the power to learn about the stuff out there. And then the stunning discovery that stuff out there actually constructed us. I mean, Einstein didn't know this. Newton didn't know this, but it was by pursuing this idea that we could understand this stuff out there that we discovered it was actually an ongoing process, a 14 billion year process that led to us, including our power to understand the whole thing.
Yeah.
So the universe invented humanity as a way to understand itself. That would be one way to talk about this absolutely unexpected reversal to the whole scientific process.
And what's so challenging at times, I would imagine, is that it's not the discovery of something new or kind of like knowing the math or knowing how to engage in the process. It's actually the way that one has to change one's consciousness or awareness of reality when things begin to shift and point in another direction. And that's like, you know, I think of Einstein, for example, and this notion of the expanding universe, which was so hard for Einstein to accept, right?
Yeah.
And even harder still, I think, is this idea that when we talk about the universe story or talk about the cosmos, we are talking about ourselves. Pouring Cheerios in my daughter's bowl this morning for breakfast, like that's part of the same story. It's not a different story.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a different story. And the way Thomas Berry put it, which, as you know, Theodore is my principal teacher, but the way he put it, it was really great, I thought. He said, we have a small self and a great self. Everyone has a small self and a great self. There's two ways of looking at who we are. And the small self comes into existence, lives a few decades. But the great self, the universe as a whole, is what enabled the small self to emerge. So when we take in the fact that all of the calcium, I mean, think of all the calcium in your bones, every one of those atoms was created by a star, several stars that exploded, so that our bones are built out of an exploded star. And so now we have this amazing identity. This is who we are. We are this vast 14 billion year process now brought into the form of the human. So all of the discoveries that science has made, biology, astronomy, archaeology, all of those discoveries are discoveries of ourself. That's who we are. And like you say, I'm not today going to talk about some weird discovery of a new species at the bottom of the ocean. That'd be interesting. Or to talk about an exploding black hole that we didn't know about before. That'd be a nice discovery. But the discovery that I'm trying to reflect on with you is the discovery that we have to change our fundamental view of the universe. I mean, this has happened before. For a long time, we thought the Earth was flat, just a great plane. And then we realized it's a ball going around a star. So we made that big shift, the Copernican shift. And now we're being asked to do something far greater than that, but similar. And the simplest way to say it is, as I've indicated, that we are a 14 billion year creative process. We're composed of exactly the same creative energy and material that gave birth to everything in the universe.
So what we're talking about here is we're talking about a cosmology, right? And I'd like you maybe to unpack that word a little bit for people listening. So, you know, I think people are somewhat familiar with the notion of cosmology as you put in the beginning, like talking about stars and galaxies out there. But when we're talking about it more kind of philosophically or culturally in terms of what a cosmology actually means and like eliminating some of that kind of dualism between the universe out there and us, like what does that mean to you when we're talking about a cosmology?
Yeah, cosmology is just not a common word, but the simple definition to me is this. Cosmology is a study of the nature of the universe and of the human role in the universe. So cosmology is saying something about what it means to be human. So this questioning refers to all of us, no matter what role we're performing in society. Cosmology addresses that role. You take a dental hygienist, What is their role? Well, their role is to clean teeth, right? That's their job, the description. Now, then you go to a larger level and you ask the same question. What is she or he doing? They are adding to the health of a human being. And in general sense, then, we can see their work as contributing to the health and well-being of humanity, the whole. And so then that's a wonderful thing. My life is to bring forth a healthy human and healthy humanity. But then the next question is, why? Why? What's the larger meaning of that? And this is where cosmology comes in. And it is the cosmological approach then is to say this. We exist in order to bring forth a unified humanity. This would be the large scale, a large scale view of what it means to be human. Now, just to say a couple words about that, when I say our cosmological role is to contribute to the unification of humanity, I'm not quoting from some sacred Bible or text or anything. I'm not getting this idea from an elder in the village, all of which is very important. This observation comes from reflection on the 14 billion year process. In the 14 billion year process, the universe is very clearly aiming at developing community, complex communities. And we see this, if you now focused right down to the human, humans began for hundreds of thousands and even millions of years. Early humans lived in groups of a couple dozen. And then through our development, we learned how to come together as a village of several thousand. And then we learned how to come together and organize ourselves in cities of several million. Now, what has to be appreciated here is the fact that this is an accomplishment. Humans can do this. It's amazing that we can do this because the other apes cannot. Now, at one time, we were identical with chimpanzees, and we've evolved away from them, but only in a very tiny way are we different. 1% difference in our DNA. Here's an image that makes everything clear. Say you're going to a professional ball game, and you're in the stands with, say, 50,000 other humans, and you're yelling and screaming and having a good time and all the rest of it. If you replaced each of the humans with a chimpanzee, there would be mass insanity. They wouldn't know what was going on. They would start to kill each other. This has been observed. Chimpanzees never had to develop the need, the capacity to live together, but we humans have. And right now, we're at this critical stage, having gone from the hunter-gatherers and into villages and cities. Now we're separated by nation states, identity with a nation state. But we are learning how to become planetary humans, one global, interconnected, planetary humanity, living harmoniously together. It almost sounds ridiculous to say that because we have so much strife. But what I'm trying to suggest is that an examination of the universe as a whole indicates a role that humans are living out, and that is to unify the species in a deep way. This would be what cosmology offers to this question, who am I? Why am I here? What am I doing?
Yeah, thank you for that. It's like, I think that it's just to pull apart like some of that, the uniqueness of human beings. I mean, I'm curious what you'd say about this. It feels like part of what we're capable of as humans, it's that we're able to, and this has to do with this notion of a cosmology, we're able to then tell a story, share it with each other through language and symbol, and figure out how to extend some of that love that we have for our immediate kin, and imagine that same, at least some sense of that love beyond the immediate kin, that we're able to kind of work together and cooperate and feel that sense of kinship beyond our own very small, tight-knit unit and extend it beyond. And even in some senses, to imagine kinship beyond the human.
It's just so great to hear you say that, Theodore. Like, wow. That is exactly, it's just so amazing. Via the imagination, just as you said it, we can establish these deep bonds really with any entity in the universe. I'm just moved thinking of it.
So not to put a damper on that, we also have, on the other hand, we also have, because we painted sort of a pretty picture of humanity here.
Yeah.
But we also have, because a cosmology can work really well and show us the way towards deeper connection, right? Deeper communion.
Yeah.
But we can also have a dysfunctional cosmology. And as I look at planetary crisis that we're experiencing, mass extinction, climate change, the way we are living in a dysfunctional relationship.
Yeah.
How did you experience that in relation to this notion of story? Like, how did you begin to experience the fact that we are living in a way that is unsustainable because we have a story that is not leading us towards deeper community relationship?
Yeah. One way I would approach that really deep question is to say that the human species is unique. It's also possible to say that every species out of the 30 million on planet Earth, each one of them is unique. And so the question is, in what way is humanity unique? And this too would have multiple answers, but the insight that I want to bring up here in relationship to your question is that of symbolic language. Symbolic language that can actually be expressed orally and that can be a given form in the world and enabling that form to go down the generations. So that what this means is that when someone makes a giant discovery, some human makes this huge discovery, that discovery can be passed down through generations. And so it can be beneficial to the entire human species. There's no other species we know of that can do that. I stress that all animals and plants have their own language. So language is everywhere, signals and the ability to communicate, that's throughout. But that's different. What I'm trying to emphasize here is that ability to put our thoughts into clay tablets or on rock walls, that ability was never seen in the 3.5 billion years of life. That's never occurred before. And that ability, I go back to this point of the chimpanzees are 99% identical with us. So that we started off very similar, but over the last millions of years that we've split off from the chimpanzees, they've stayed right there. They live in the same way they lived the last 30 million years.
But some of them are very clever individually.
And very clever individually, and discovering all kinds of things.
But not reading Genesis that was written thousands of years ago, right?
That's right. No, exactly. And so that difference, to be able to do that, is what enabled us to build cities and libraries and, you know, go to the moon and compose symphonies. And the point I want to make is that power, let me just call it symbolic consciousness, using linguistic symbols, that power led to the human takeover of the planet. That power is a biological and cosmological power. And we haven't yet taken that in. So we are using that power to carry out aims that were appropriate to species before humans arrived. So all mammals are trying to be fruitful and multiply. So naturally, we're trying to be fruitful and multiply, and we exploded into all these billions. So I think it's helpful and important to realize that this species, this bizarre and gifted species, is just learning how to handle a planetary power. We're in that time. We're in that changeover from other stories of the past. They were not written with any awareness that we have now. There's not an awareness of this spectacular technological power that we have. So I feel deeply that the articulation of this new understanding in language, in art, in music, the articulation of this new story is what we require now to arrive at the deeper wisdom that still is latent within us. And let me just say, it has been expressed in different ways in the past, but we're struggling right now to give birth to a story that will guide us into the deeper destiny of humanity.
Thank you for that, Brian. That's beautiful. I think that it's understanding. I think that's, it's devoid of shame for all of the errors of humanity too. You know what I mean? Like thinking through and being present to things that require change without focusing on the shame and the negativity around what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
I think that's really probably a healthier way of thinking about it. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return to talk in a more positive sense about where the new cosmology might point us.
Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, the crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions, rather it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
Talking today with cosmologist, scientist, philosopher, teacher, Brian Swim. And we were just discussing the cosmology, the new cosmology, and how, as this new cosmology might emerge, some of the challenges we have as a species, because of the uniqueness of the human and our role that we play in the universe, and how we're learning how to embrace that role and understand it, really. I wanted to ask you, Brian, you know, you've spent so much time investigating and trying to come to an understanding of not just the process of the universe, not just understanding how it happened, but figuring out what it actually means for us now today as humans. And I think, like, for example, you know, one of the things that I often think about is, like, what if we thought of the universe as primarily, I think about this kind of as an educator a lot. If we think about a classroom or a process as primarily relationship, rather than thinking about it as a context for individual competition, we think if we put the relationship primary, how does that shift how we must then engage in the world? So for you, I'm just curious, you know, and I know you have many different kind of thoughts, but how would you say that some ways that we, as we begin to understand the universe story and how the universe story is us, how does that change for you how we then move in our world?
Yeah, I guess maybe to pick one example of the change, picking up the image you have there of the classroom. Well, when I was in grade school, we were taught to compete with each other. We even had games, math games, where we children were seeing who's the fastest and the best. Constantly, it was about competition and spelling bees and all of that. I'm not saying it was all evil, but what I came to understand is that the real creativity comes out of relationship. And there are just different ways of talking about this. just to give a couple images about, if you take a neutron, an elementary particle, there are neutrons and protons. If you take a neutron, you leave it by itself, it has a happy existence for a few minutes, and then it disintegrates. But if you take a neutron and you bring it into relationship with a proton, that little duo will exist for billions of years. My point with this, I mean, it just, when I learned that, it really blew my mind. I had been deeply convinced that the ultimate reality was atoms. You know, we're composed of these atoms. But no, that neutron changes. It comes into a new form by entering into relationship. So then, having thought about this for years, I realized that all of the things that I've done, not saying it's a lot, but I'm just saying the creativity that I've been involved in, all came out of relationship. I didn't ever create anything on my own, really. Even if I was in a room by myself, I was interacting with all these people from the past. I read their books, you know, many of them, most of them are dead. It doesn't matter. But out of that mix came forth things, books and lectures. I think that switch is, it's been really exciting for me. And I'll tell you a little practice I have that it might appeal to others. It is, let me just say one more little thing. Not little, but it's one last thing before I do my practice. And that is, for 3 billion years, life on planet Earth was unicellular. Every organism was just a single cell. And then they started to get together and they started to, you know, form communities. And through their relationships, they gave birth to whales, gorillas, humans. It wasn't that somebody from outer space came here. It was just the cells entering into relationship. And like, wow. See, there's relationship evokes cosmic creativity. That's what we've learned from the story itself. So here's my practice. I don't do this every day, but I do it a lot. I start off the day and I go through the day. And when I'm interacting with people, I will ask myself, just myself inside, I'll ask myself the question, what piece of my creativity do you have? And what piece of your creativity do I have? That will only come about when we enter into relationship. And I'm not saying I enter into relationship with everyone, but I think of it because it's not just humans by any means, but our creativity, our potential creativity is distributed throughout all the other entities of the world. And we can't discover it except by entering into relationship with them. If you try it, it can really change the way you go through the day.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking when you were talking about production of creative stuff, right? And it's true. When you're writing something, you're writing it, you might write it by yourself, but you're really bringing together an entire universe of wisdom of all the people who've told you stuff and influences you have. And something some guy said to you at the cafe last week, like you're bringing all that into your work. Yeah, and then the other side too, what's also cool is that, so when does the actual art happen? I think of it like, or the idea really come to life, you know, with this notion of in quantum physics about how we don't actually have this precise location until we have an actual observation, right? Yeah. You know, and there's all different ways of thinking about that. And people talk about multiple universe theories and things like that. And I think what's most helpful for me to think about that is that it happens because nothing exists without relationship. And it's when there is an actual relationship, that's when something is brought forth into existence in a real way in our universe. Yeah. And it's the same with an idea or poem or a song or anything else. It kind of exists as you created it in your studio or in your house or sitting under a tree. But where it really exists is when you share it and you do it in relationship. That changes the whole way we think about human creativity. That's, I think, great. When we think about it as relational, you know what I mean?
I love that. It doesn't exist until we share it. That is, And you're connecting that up with the collapse of the wave function,
right?
The quantum
right.
level. That is really great, Theodore. I love it.
I think we are primarily a relational species too, aren't we? Yeah. We're like, you know, that is kind of fundamental about what it means to be human. We're not as maybe as fast as some of the other animals that we would have encountered as we evolved in Africa. We don't have the sharpest teeth. You know what I mean? Like yeah. Yeah. The one thing we're actually good at, which is funny because sometimes we resist it so much, but the one thing we're actually good at, and this would be surprising to some people, but we're actually good at relationship with each other, at building these kind of meaningful relationships. It's maybe a thing we ought to pursue
that more. Just to dwell on it, because I think you put your finger right on it. In trying to think about language and so forth and relationship, I mean, I just imagine this situation on the African plains. Just imagine this one wildebeest being attacked by some lions, lionesses, and it doesn't go well at first, but he gets out of it. There's some kind of move. He gets out of it, and it's almost like mm-hmm. he discovered how to deal with the difficult situation. Then he goes back to the herd, and he has some friends for sure. They look at him, and they can pick up that something drastic has happened, but he can't tell them. He will never be able to share that with them. Even they have a bond, they're friends and so forth. But I mean, I guess the reason it meant so much to me just thinking about that is that when we meet someone, what do? We ask them about what their preferences, their tastes, their values, ultimately their story, and find out where they came from, what do they focus on, what they do. And in all of that, we enter into this deep, deep relationship that other mammals can't quite enjoy, because we can bring the past, the whole narrative past, into the present and understand that that person is all of that, not just what's there present now, but all that in the history. I don't know, just that ability to enter into deep relationships is a thrilling process for sure. And it is at the core of all creativity.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
And one of the, as you were talking, like one of the things that struck me was absolutely that traditionally, and it's true, I think in a less formal way now, one of the things we do when we meet each other, we encounter each other, we try to figure out like, who are you people? Where do you come from? And we're doing that in a way because we think there might be a way that we are kin. There might be a way that we're connected, right? Isn't that one of our aims in doing that? Like we're trying to uncover like knowledge, you know, wisdom, things like that. But it's also a way to uncover how are we kin? How do we connect to each other? How can we figure out a way that we ought to be, you know, then taking care of each other maybe?
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. And you know, you can even watch people do that. And they're talking, they're kind of checking this out, checking that out, looking for kinship, like you say. And then when they find something that they both share, they just explode with like, oh my God, you love the Chicago Cubs. You know, they're just going on and on, they go back and forth, they talk and talk. And it kind of an explosion of creativity takes place as soon as they discover their kinship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we have just, you know, a little time left here. And I wanted to talk about ideas and ways of thinking, which are in a lot of, I think what we're talking about here is this awakening. And I think your book, Cosmogenesis, in a lot of ways, is about your own awakening as a younger person. And I mean that in a very kind of Buddhist sense, right? Like awakening to a new way of thinking and being in the world. And there's a different phase to that kind of on a civilizational level, though, right? There's the way that we can individually sit under the Bodhi tree and change our view of ourselves and the world, which is useful and helpful. But then also we have all these institutions that even if we as individuals, and even if many individuals in the world begin to take on these new ways of thinking and this new form of consciousness, institutions then become, can be at least at times, obstacles to change, right? Because they tend to move slower. Like, what do you see as like maybe for, because I think we're still talking about first steps here. How do you see like, what in terms of moving large institutions, moving like a civilization, like where do you see the inklings of possibility to move institutions and systems?
Well, I would want to tell you about the thinking of a philosopher who was really has a lot to say on this point. But just to tell your listeners, his name is Wolfgang Leithold. And the book he has just published is The History of Experience. And it means so much to me because it's a profound study of the evolution of humanity, and in particular, the evolution of human experience. And it bears directly on your question, Theodore. The way his basic point of view, which has been present in our conversation, although I didn't use his name, but it is that we regard the human and the chimpanzee, as I mentioned, as separating. We don't know when exactly, but 6-7 million years ago, we separated. And the difference between chimpanzees and humans is primarily the way in which we've transformed our mentality. And so at one time, we didn't have a developed sense of the self. And that was a huge breakthrough. And then at one time, we didn't have a real deep sense of cosmic order. You can see this in the cave paintings. The animals are all brilliantly rendered, but they're just put up there. A lion is right here and a horse is there. And there's no sense of the order of the ecosystem that in which they lived that came later. So I mentioned these previous transformations to suggest that we are in the midst of yet another. Now, Leithold recognizes and identifies 9 of these transformations. So we would be in the 10th. They're not linear, but they show up all over the planet in different ways. But if he's correct, I believe he is, then we are involved in something really deep, something that's deep as the entire history of Western civilization. It goes to another level. And I'd get to right to your point, the transformation goes through a series of steps. And the first is, I know this is kind of long, but I think it's worth thinking about. The first is incubation. Incubation is a stage when certain individuals are coming up with another form of experience, another form of consciousness. And the second is articulation, what you were just saying, Theodore, sharing, sharing this experience so others can awaken to it. And the third is a methodology. So it becomes systematic throughout a society of this transformation taking place. And then last step is institutionalization, where this new way of being a human is now used to give structure to the major institutions of economy and education and governance. So I think we are right now in that sequence. We're in the stage of articulation. We're in the stage of communities that are surfacing with a new sense. And that's how I see my own work, is that I lucked out. I found a community where these ideas were, understood and appreciated and pursued. But we were just one little tiny community, philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Tiny, tiny, tiny. But in that little community, we could begin to really share and to articulate what was taking place. So I see this, other communities are surfacing, and my colleague and your colleague as well, Richard Tarnas, he calls these heroic communities. I love that phrase. These heroic communities are surfacing at different places on the planet, and we're on a pathway toward giving birth to new institutions, but I don't see that actually happening anytime soon. I think it's going to be a long period, maybe a century, of deepening this understanding of the universe that we have recently acquired and living into it, not just knowing it theoretically, but manifesting it in our daily lives. And just to finish this, that was my main reason in writing Cosmogenesis. I wanted to show how the universe was surfacing in my life, because my hope is other people would read it and go, I've had that experience too, but in a completely different setting. It was at Starbucks and this happened and that happened, but that was the universe coming into my own experience. That's my hope, is that it'll activate creativity in, among artists and musicians and writers.
I think that so often one of the reasons to share our stories is because people have experiences that they think are unique. And they are unique maybe in some ways, but that they think they're alone in those experiences.
Yeah.
And then they read someone else's story and they realize they're not alone.
Yeah.
And just as we're so fundamentally, I think, yearning for relationship and community, that I think that the flourishing of this new form of consciousness requires that sense that we're not alone in those experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that pushing back against that kind of tendency towards thinking that we have to do it alone is part of the great work.
Absolutely.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today and reimagining with us today. And thank you for all your work.
You're welcome, Theodore. And thank you so much for inviting me and the great work you're doing. God, I'm so impressed.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.